Hi, I'm Bruce Arians, and you're listening to the Neil Reynolds Podcast.
In the Neil Reynolds Podcast. I am Neil Reynolds, and if this is your first time listening, thank you very much. Be sure to go back and listen to episode one when I went fishing with Ryan Fitzpatrick. That'll give you an idea of what we're trying to do with the Neil Reynolds Podcast. We're trying to take NFL fans inside the game and tell some really great stories. So on to episode two with one of the most colourful and coolest coaching figures in NFL history. Bruce Arians began his coaching career at Virginia Tech back in 1975, but incredibly didn't become a full-time head coach in the NFL until 2013, when he took charge of the Arizona Cardinals at the age of 60. By that time, he'd already won the first of two NFL Coach of the Year awards as interim boss of the 2012 Indianapolis Colts. He's a man who's feared and loved by his players in equal measure, and his no risk it, no biscuit approach makes his teams competitive and fun to watch. Bruce Arians has quite a story to tell, so let's get into my conversation with him.
So I'm sitting in the office of head coach of the Tampa Bay Buccaneers, Bruce Arians. Bruce, coach, thank you for joining us, agreeing to do this. I just said to you there before we started recording, I don't think I can get your life story in 25 minutes. It's been quite a ride, isn't it?
It's a tough one. It's been a journey.
Yeah, tell us about growing up in Pennsylvania. Was football a big part of your life from the get-go?
Yeah, all sports. You know, I played, you know, both mom and dad worked, so I had to be on a team somewhere. And so it was basketball, baseball, football, a little bit of track, not much, but at an early age, I learned to love football.
I look at Pennsylvania, George Blanda, Joe Namath, Jim Kelly, Dan Marino, Johnny Yu, Joe Montana. What was it about that area? And no wonder you became a quarterback.
It's been a great football state for a long, long time. Mm. You know, and you know, football was big. You know, you got the Steelers, you got the Eagles. Back when I was growing up, Baltimore Colts were only 50 miles from my house, and they were my team. I love Johnny Unitas and Raymond Berry and Lenny Moore. I thought was one of the greatest athletes ever.
Mm. So, what was it about Johnny U that you liked?
Just has always came back and won. You know, he always had to come back in him, and I love the way he threw the football. I tried to pattern myself after the way he threw a football, and just, you know, we had black and white TV, and then we got some Colts games, so it's like very something to ever watch college football. It was amazing.
So being a young quarterback, which you were, you know, as you went through your football career, being a young quarterback from Pennsylvania, just the names I list, it's almost better not to think about it.
There's a thousand like me who weren't very good. Maybe 10,000.
I read that you kind of spent a lot of time growing up around your grandfather ran a bar, right?
That was when I was very young.
And
very
I wonder young. If I'm going to put two and two together here and come up with six, but people in bars, they speak their mind, they tell it like it is, and I think you do that, right? I mean, did you see that?
I think, you know, when I was, he'd sit me on a stool and drink all the birch beer until I got sick, and, you know, and just watched him. He was on the phone all the time, and I said, boy, Grandpa, you got a lot of friends. Then I didn't realize he was a bookie until later in life, and, you know, so it was like, but yeah, and then I attended bar in college, and you learn to be a good listener.
Going to ask you about that in a second. I know there's a story about when you were attending bar, which will be a good one. Did you have a kind of drive to make your parents proud? What did you learn from your parents, Jimmy?
Oh gosh, the hardest working people I know. My dad, you know, always said you give everything you have, and then the rest of the time you spend with your family, and you give your boss your best. And Mom too, she was the same way. So it was always bad when Mom was working nights and Dad was working days because he couldn't cook worth a damn.
You didn't have microwaves back then, probably.
No, but, no, he made us eat oatmeal with a raw egg in it one time. I thought Mom was going to kill him.
What about your road to college? Because you played high school football.
Mm-hmm. It was a unique story, and that
gets a little bumpy.
I got kicked out of high school my senior year, the day after football season, and went to York High to graduate, and of the teams who were recruiting me at the time, only one stuck with me, and that was John Devlin. at Virginia Tech, and I couldn't sign that scholarship fast enough.
It's funny when, and I think I'll learn this as I go through this podcast, Coach, when you talk to different players and coaches, there is no one tried and tested route to the NFL. Right? It doesn't work that way. Some of the greatest players and coaches have had to overcome tremendous adversity. Is that fair?
I think so. I think that makes you stronger. Mm. I know for me, it was a driving force for a very, very long time to see my dad, to see the pride back in his face.
So it was like you used that?
Oh, I used almost that as motivation for a very long time.
Mm. Tell me then about when you were working your bartending job in college. Can you tell us that story?
I was a young coach, and at night I'd worked bars, and then we finally had a discotheque open up. And, one of the guys from up on the mountain came down, and I knew him. It's like, hey, this isn't you need to go up to Hokie House or Carlisle's. And, I like it now. So you start grabbing a couple of girls. It's like, you got to leave. You can't do that in here. And then he came back later armed and wanted to know if I would throw him out now. And the proprietor, who was trying to get me to be in the bar business with him, knocked him out with a blackjack and said, I think coaching might be safer.
Did he actually pull a gun on you?
Oh, yeah.
So is that one of those classic?
I knew he wasn't going to shoot me. But
oh, you called it. You knew.
But
that's some confidence there, Coach.
Yeah, because I knew him, so.
After his somewhat bumpy road to college football, Arians began life at Virginia Tech as the scout team quarterback. He was buried deep on the depth chart, but he was not just mimicking the offenses of opposing teams. He was making mental notes and laying his own foundation. So how much did that help him get to where he is today?
I got to run every offense known to man as a scout team quarterback. And so I developed ideas and philosophies from each and every one of those, and whether it be the split back veer, drop back passing, wishbone, all the things that were prevalent in the 70s. And then my fifth year, I actually was going to graduate and go coach junior high football. Mm. And we got a new coach, met him. He talked me into coming back out, basically told me, look, I'll tell you in 10 days if you're going to help our team. If not, I'll get you a high school job.
Right.
Well, I couldn't get a junior high job at the time, so I said, what I got to lose but about 20 pounds. Went back out, ended up being captain and most valuable player.
So with that, when you're looking at that scout team and you're learning all those things, did you have a roadmap in your mind of, I think coaching might be for me down the road? Because many players at that age wouldn't have taken those lessons of all those things.
I always knew I wanted to coach. Mm. Everybody I looked up to in my life was named Coach. I thought the high school coaches were rich because their houses weren't attached to anybody else's. And they had two cars. They didn't know they were all broken down, but they had two cars.
It was a different level.
I mean, that was rich to me. So it was like, I thought teachers made a lot of money. Mm. How naive was I?
And you did have that one year. Would you have 11 rushing touchdowns? Vick couldn't get near it.
Michael, nobody got it. And I think Evans might have tied it. But he played 15 games. So I don't count it.
No, that doesn't count. That doesn't count. That's very different then. Tell me about Jimmy Sharp. It's a name that a lot of people won't know. Mm-hmm. He was your coach there, and then he joined his staff.
Yeah, he was the guy that talked me into coming back out and giving it a shot. So there were about seven guys, I think, that were eligible for a fifth year. So I talked to them all coming back out. So you're going to like this new coach. And we went into what we called winter workouts back then, which was just death march. And I was about to quit. I was so out of shape, and he pulled me over. He said, take a knee. He said, your buddies said meet them at Carlisle's. They're all gone, but I want you to stay here. And they blew the whistle. It was six stations. So he waited. He said, you think you can make the last one? Oh, yeah. He did that every day until I could make them all. So I knew he was special.
Yeah.
And we had a bond.
Yeah.
I played for him, and then they had the old World Football League. And I was thinking about signing with the Birmingham Vulcans and backing up George Myra, who was one of my idols, and Coach had come from Alabama. So he said, I don't know if they're going to make payroll. I think you'll be a hell of a coach. I'll offer you graduate assistantship. So I didn't take much thought about it and decided to start my coaching career there.
So it wasn't a hard decision to because all players have self-belief. Mm-hmm. To even get to college football, mm-hmm. you would have had tremendous self-belief in yourself as a player to go through high mm-hmm. school, to get to college. So then you had to accept
knew,
it was over.
I knew the end game was always going to be coaching.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. So it was like, do I want to go play in this league that who knows if it's going to make it or not, just right. to play, or start on this staff who not only was it Coach Sharp, Charlie Pell, Danny Ford, Nelson Stokley, all head coaches, and Terry Don Phillips, who ended up being the athletic director at Clemson. We're all on this coaching staff. It was a great coaching staff. Yeah.
So as we just alluded to there, Bruce Arians became a starter at quarterback as a senior in 1974. He set a single season rushing record with 11 touchdowns, which couldn't be broken by the aforementioned explosive and great Michael Vick. As a coach, Arians would go on to tutor some of the great quarterbacks such as Peyton Manning, Ben Roethlisberger, Andrew Luck, Carson Palmer, and now, of course, Tom Brady. But how would he assess himself as a quarterback?
I think I went two games without completing a pass, but I scored three touchdowns. So we might throw it five times a game, six times a game, unless we were down. And my greatest play was a failure. Threw a touchdown pass on the last play of the game against Virginia. And we're down by one, so we go for two. I jump over the goal line. I'm laying in the end zone thinking we won the game, and the referees decided I didn't make it. It's like, whoa. So I got remembered for that play more than scoring any touchdowns.
Right. No replay to help you out there,
Dave. No replay.
I've got a number here, which it relates to the college football coaching you did and in the NFL. The number is 429. And that's the passing yards that you coaxed out of Dave Marler in a game at Mississippi State and Kelly Holcomb when he was at Cleveland in a wild card game against yes. Pittsburgh. Is that some things that coaches take pride in?
Oh.
And maybe tell us the Dave Marler story and why that's unique.
Dave Marler is a very unique story in that he was our kicker, a straight-on kicker. He had transferred to Mississippi State. They were a wishbone team. We were going to pass the ball. And one of his buddies kept saying, you need to look at Marler. So, all right, so I looked at had a pretty good stroke. So we're in a scrimmage. We had a great defense at State then, and we couldn't make a first down. So I said, put Marler in, and we were right down the score. The rest is history. But that game against Alabama, he was still our kicker. Mm-hmm. And in pregame warmups, he kicks the ball and pulls his thigh muscle and couldn't walk. It's like, oh, there goes the whole game plan. And but we had put in the shotgun. Our center had actually played in the single wing in high school, so he could snap it. We put him back 7 yards, and we had some plays, about four plays for Alabama, because they blitzed a lot. And so Dave came out, and I got him on the phone. I said, you think you could stand back there in the shotgun and throw the ball? I said, oh, yeah. So we put in those plays. And I'm up in the press box drawing up the rest of our offense in the shotgun. And we go at halftime, and we're still close. And we put in the rest of the offense where he could just stand back there and hand it off every now and then. And he threw for a record-breaking day in the SEC. And I think he was the SEC Player of the Year.
It's an incredible story. And Kelly Holcomb the same way. I wonder how you take – whether you take pride in that as a coach, because obviously – Peyton Manning's going to have his achievements, but those kind of stories.
I didn't have anything to do with Peyton Manning, Ben Roethlisberger, Andrew Luck. God made those, and their mom and dad. I can take some credit for Kelly and him sticking with it. And every time we'd put him in the game, he'd throw for 400 yards mm-hmm. and was like the ultimate competitor. But, yeah, he's the guy I take the most pride in.
The Dave Marler incident made one of the giants of coaching, Paul Bear Bryant, sit mm-hmm. up and take notice. Mm-hmm. You had an interview with him, I think. Did I read that you didn't? You were so enthralled with him, you didn't even ask what your salary would be?
Yeah,
is that true?
I actually took the job, and I went back to Starkville, and my wife said, well, how much are you making? I said, oh, we didn't talk about it. You took a job that you don't even know what you're making? I said, man, he knows what I'm making. I hope he gives me a raise, you know, and he did. He gave me a heck of a raise.
Now, Coach Arians' office screams power and success. In fact, it's a real statement of intent. And I'm pretty sure my chair was actually set a couple of inches lower than his, that classic power move. But behind him are two Super Bowl trophies that he won with the Pittsburgh Steelers, two Coach of the Year prizes, game ball spanning 45 years in college and the pros, and a whole bunch of family photos. But the prized possession sits over Arian's right shoulder. It's a giant photo of legendary college coach Paul Bear Bryant, the man who won 6 national championships at Alabama and a man who shaped Bruce Arian's career.
He's always been there. He's always been there ever since I left Alabama. And one of my players at Temple, my first year's dad, made that for me.
Yes.
And so, yeah, I learned so much with him dealing with people. He was a master of personnel and people. He was still an X and O guy, but not as much at that time. But we played 66 players in a game at Alabama. All right? He substituted every player.
Right.
All right, no coach put a guy in, or you get your butt fired.
He did all of that.
He did it all. And we played 3 quarterbacks, and he knew when to put which one in. I love telling a story about we're at Kentucky, and Kentucky's about to upset us. And we get the ball on the 1-yard line, and I had 9 running backs dressed. I was a running back. He put in the last string. I'm like, what are we doing? You know, he's like, and darn if they don't make like 3 plays and we're out to the 20, here come the starters, we go down and score, we win the game. It's like, never question him ever again.
I guess that's the essence of coaching. It's as much about relationships and people as it is about the X's and O's.
That's the whole thing. It really is. It's, you know, it's getting guys to believe in a certain culture and a responsibility and accountability to each other for a common cause. And the cause is always the championship.
You learned a lot from him. Some of the last things he said to you, you took forward with you, mm-hmm. right? Because when I've talked to a lot of players who've played for you, and they say, coach is tough on us, mm-hmm. but then he'll be really, but we love him as well. Mm-hmm. And did you get that from
Bear
Bryant?
Yes, that I saw him do it. I mean, we'd all be in jail if we coached the way we did back in the 70s and 80s. And he'd walk in and find a kid in the locker room. And then the last thing he told me when I took that job at Temple, he said, coach him hard and hug him later. Right. And it's always been my philosophy.
Those were some of the last words Coach Bryant spoke to Arians. Just over 4 weeks after coaching Alabama to victory in the Liberty Bowl, Bear Bryant suffered a massive heart attack and died age 69. Arians moved on to Temple, and at the age of 30, he assumed his first head coaching role. And it's fair to say that at that time, he learned some lessons the hard way.
I thought I had to be the head coach, offense coordinator, recruiting coordinator, quarterback coach, fundraiser. Every job, I had to do it myself. And I never learned how to delegate, which landed me in the hospital the last 2 years a lot. Mm. And stress will do that to you. But until Chuck got sick in Indianapolis, and all of a sudden, 24 hours later, I'm in charge. Not the head coach, but I'm in charge. Mm. And said, everybody just do your job. I'll just decide whether we go for it on 4th down or not, because I don't give speeches.
Right.
And it worked. So I found out that if I ever got an opportunity, I could call plays, I could be a head coach and delegate and let people do their jobs.
And I know I've been fortunate to interview you before, and you've told me that. So you went from Temple, where you make yourself sick, to Arizona or here, where you've told you will chase your assistant coaches out of the door mm-hmm. and tell them to go home. That's a complete change.
Oh, yeah. And it was, you know, back then it was to work yourself to death. And I realized later, as I missed some of my son and daughters growing up, how much I missed. And how much wasted time was in the office. And I tell my guys, if you miss a game, a recital, anything to do with your kids, I'll fire you. Because there's plenty of time to come back to the office or get up early tomorrow and get it done. Mm. But you don't get that time back.
Yeah. Tell me about some of the NFL quarterbacks. We just mentioned some of them. Peyton Manning, Big Ben, Andrew Luck, Carson Palmer. All a little bit different. Any common themes? What for you makes a great one?
They'll kill you to win. whatever it takes, they're going to win. Mm. And I don't care if it's dominoes, ping pong, golf, whatever they're playing, they play to win. And I think all the great ones have it, and they have a way of instilling it to other people. Just they can impose their will on you to win.
Mm. Is it for you as well what they do with their mind and the accuracy as opposed to hey, I can throw it 70 yards.
Yeah, that really has nothing. It helps, but how seldom do you ever throw one that far unless it's a broken play?
Right.
We can't block them that long. So to me, it's your head and your heart. You play with your brain and your toughness, your interior toughness, and that's what leads men. Mm. And quarterback has to be a leader of men.
In 1998, Arians became the first quarterback coach of a certain Peyton Manning. The super intelligent young passer presented the veteran coach with a real challenge, but Arians was up to the task as he set Manning on a Hall of Fame trajectory.
He had to have every T crossed and every I dotted before he could play. And he was the most challenging guy I ever coached, because if I had, say, an hour meeting with him, I would have to have 2 hours worth of material. Now, poor Kelly, he's over there just lost, because Peyton, he was like what's the fish that eats everybody?
A piranha.
Piranha. And he was the piranha of information.
Wow. And Big Ben, you won two Super Bowls with him. What was he like?
He was probably just the opposite. Okay. You could overload him with information. He just let him play. He knew his game plan. The second Super Bowl, he and I had gotten into a relationship where I let him call plays, because he would run the ball. Mm. And so it was a situation where, it was total trust. We put that thing together. And once you have a quarterback all in, his accountability level is extremely high when he knows it's a part of him and it's not just being dictated to him, and he's not a robot. We had a great relationship.
So that's coaching as well, isn't it? It's like overload Peyton Manning and make sure you don't overload Big Ben. It's learning the learning.
Yeah. And Andrew was kind of a combination of the two.
Okay.
He could eat it up, but he also had a freedom about the way he played the game, and it was very hard on himself. Mm. I can remember him coming out of the game and he threw a touchdown. He said, "That's got to be the ugliest damn touchdown ever." I said, "Yeah, but it's a touchdown. Don't worry about it."
Still counts for six.
Yeah. So, but he was a combination of both of them.
What was that 2012 season like? Because as coaches, you spend so much time together. It's probably a real brotherhood of coaches. Mm-hmm. So you're going through the emotion of worrying about Coach Pagano, but you're the one that's got to keep the team on the rails.
I think Thursday night of the first week, I was sitting in my office, had a panic attack. I don't have panic attacks. Mm. It was a little overwhelming. How am I going to get this done? And still, is he going to get better? I calmed down, and it was just, the first game, Mr. Irsay, our owner, said, "We're going to beat the Green Bay Packers, and we're going to take this game ball down to Chuck." Thanks. That's all we needed. A little more pressure. And I've never feared losing in my life except Coach Bryant's last game in the Liberty Bowl.
Yeah.
And this game. And we're losing 21-3 at half, and we'd had a good week of practice, but we weren't very good. And basically at halftime, all we need to do is make one good play and it's gonna snowball. Mm. Reggie Wayne stood up, Corey Redding stood up, they kinda got the guys fired up. Gerard Powers goes out, intercepts Aaron Rodgers. We go in and score, and we win the game on the last play of the game. And to me, it was still number one. I've won two Super Bowls. I don't come close to that game.
Okay, that's the one for you.
That's
you
the one.
Picking one.
That
that's
one and Temple beating Pitt for the first time in 45 years.
Yeah, absolutely. And then you got the chance to be a head coach, 60 years of age, NFL head coach. For the first time, I saw the introductory press conference. You didn't have the hat on.
No.
Did they make you not wear the hat?
No. It was kind of a thing that happened after that. I always wore them, but I didn't wear them all the time.
Throughout his incredible career, Arians has inspired so many of his players and coaches along the way. But his reach goes way beyond the NFL. This man who has twice beaten cancer has proven to be an inspiration to so many.
I just know that people are going through really tough times when they hear that word. I heard it twice, and it was like I was very fortunate, both of mine. Didn't have to do radiation or chemo, and got it early detection. So I'm a big early detection person.
Yeah.
And get checked. And when you find it, beat it. I saw what Chuck did and how low he got and then where he's at now. And it's just and I know football had a huge part of him getting healthy.
So you have... When you go through things like that in life and you realize it is a business, but it's also a game,
mm-hmm.
and you go through all that stuff in life, and you wait until you're 60 to become a head coach. So is there a part of you that's like, I'm going to do this exactly the way I want. I'm going to say what I want because I feel like I've traveled that road.
I'm 60 and this is the last time. So I don't have to worry about getting another job.
Yeah.
And so just do it the way I want to do it. And if they don't like it, tough. And it worked. It worked for 5 years. And, you know, after the second cancer battle, a lot of things were going on. I had a grandson born, and a lot of things hit me. I thought it was time for me to get out.
Mm. And then back in again. What was it like when you were out in the TV studio?
The TV job was fun on Sunday. I didn't like the travel. And, I liked Friday practice. I love being at practice on Friday, talking to the coaches, talking to the players. I wasn't dying to get back in.
Right.
But then when this opportunity came with the Glazier family, Jason Light, the general manager, a young quarterback I liked, it was like, and all my assistant coaches were available. That was really that was the icing on the cake.
Yeah.
I was in, and then when Todd was available, Byron was available, Keith was available, Goody was available, like, yeah, I'm in. Mm. I'm in, and I'm going to give up play calling for the first time in my career.
Do you think you'll ever go back to TV, or do you think you'll always be a coach now?
Not unless there's a private jet involved.
There you go. So you're doing your negotiating already now. Do you think football, just concluding now, is football about relationships?
It's what it's all about. Mm. Yeah, for me, I knew I missed the locker room. Coaches, building young coaches. I've got four guys, I think, right now are ready to be head coach, and I've got four more of them. My job is to get them ready to be coordinators and take their place and maybe be a head coach themselves. I just feel very strongly about that.
How many times have you been fired or let go or moved on? Pittsburgh originally it said you'd retired, right?
So I just call that refired.
Right. How many times do you think?
I think it's been 9.
Okay.
Somewhere around there.
So I read that
I know I moved my wife 18 times.
Wow. Mm-hmm. 18 times. So I read that your daughter's birthday is at the end of December, right? Mm-hmm. So my daughter's birthday is in Super Bowl week. Mm-hmm. She came 2 weeks early, my youngest. And I have to apologize every year for never being at a birthday. Mm-hmm. But you probably had to go to your daughter and say, I've been fired.
Yeah, we're moving again.
How was that?
9th grade, 10th grade, 11th grade. So I told her I wouldn't move her 12th grade, so I moved.
Well, on your own?
Yeah, because we were changing jobs again. So it was hard on her.
Did you feel guilty? Or?
Oh, extremely. It was, her birthday's December 1st, and in college it was always around there, and sometimes in the pros you knew it. So it's just, we got to move, She'd cry, and my wife would get her all fired up about the next stop.
Last two, Coach, I know I'm out of time. Any regrets within?
No, just probably to some kids at Temple, I coached way too hard, those years. But they're probably the closest guys I'm still to, Four of my coaches here were captains for me at Temple, and three guys coached for me on that staff.
They showed you something, surviving.
Yeah, and so it's been a great, great ride. Looking for a few more.
That's my last question leads to that, because I know you're not done, and I know you're putting all the work in with the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. But when you are done, and I know your wife thought you were done a couple of times, right? When you were going to Indy, she thought she was going to get that retirement.
Yeah, I failed twice at it.
Yeah. When you are done and you put your feet up and you're telling your stories to your grandkids, how do you want to be remembered? How would you like to be remembered?
That I coached them hard and correctly, and that I cared about them. Has nothing to do with wins and losses.
Okay, so that's it. That's my chat with Bruce Arians, head coach of the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. It was a fun hour or so spent with Coach, and got some great insight into what's been an amazing career. So we'll turn our attention now to the mailbag for this episode. Bring in producer Gary Hayes. And Gary, obviously we got to be on location together with Coach Arians in Tampa in a very different time in the world, because now we are obviously recording this in separate locations.
It was a weird and better time then. But what I wanted to ask you about Coach Arians was, you've spoken to him a few times when you've done interviews for the NFL, for the game programs and whatnot. How did you find him when you were with him in his office in Tampa?
I don't know if it was because it was, and hopefully this is the way when we're going with this podcast, because we're not really looking to make headlines and we're not looking to break news. Hopefully all of the people we interview will be really relaxed, but that's the most relaxed, the most open, and actually quite emotional I've ever seen Coach Arians. So to get that time and to get that insight from him was really fascinating. And yeah, it definitely felt like he was really happy, really comfortable. And yeah, what a lot of great stories he told us.
Okay, so on to the questions that really matter from our listeners. Just to start with Tom Marshall, he asks, will Tampa be Bruce's last job as a head coach? I thought he had retired when he left us in Arizona.
Tom's a Cardinals fan then. Yeah, I mean, I think Bruce Arians, and he alluded to it in our conversation, he had a couple of kind of flirts with retirement. His wife had expected him to sort of put his feet up and finally call time on his career. And I thought he was going to do that in his late 50s. I thought he was going to do it when the 2017 season ended and he parted ways with the Cardinals. Then he went into TV, but the lure of coming back was too much. He's 67 years old now. This, to me, is his final run. That's why he's brought Tom Brady on board as his quarterback. He doesn't want to wait for Jameis Winston to grow out of his mistakes. So, yes, this will be his last go around, his last stop. I'm confident, given his age, the health stuff he's had in the past, this will be his last run at it with a team. And that's why he wants to, you know, give it as good a shot as he can.
You mentioned TV there and his TV career. So from Michael Lavery, he asks a question for you personally. Was TV always the end goal for you, or was it a case of being happy to cover the NFL in any form?
Honestly, TV was just the way I kind of fell into it. It was just about, for me, it was about covering the NFL, working in the NFL in some capacity. I actually started writing and covering the NFL in 1991. I didn't appear on TV until 2006. So some 15 years later, when I actually got a full-time gig on TV for Sky Sports, it was 2011. So 20 years after I'd actually started out as a journalist. And for me, it was about just being involved in the sport. I just love the sport. Some people are on TV because they want to be on TV. I'm on TV because I end up getting on TV talking about the NFL. So I started off as a written journalist. Then I worked for NFL Europe in public relations for 6 years. And frankly, I got made redundant. I got laid off. And then I was free to kind of look at other stuff. I'd written a book that got published in the US around about 2006. And somebody just said to me, why don't you come on Sky and promote your book? Did that once. And then it kind of went from there. So no, I would not. And I will happily wager that I never end up on TV talking about any other sport either. I'm an NFL guy, not a TV guy.
And there was a last bit to that question from Michael, and he said, if you have any advice to someone looking to follow in your footsteps.
I mean, for me, it is go and get that grounding as a journalist. So I worked for local newspapers. I worked from the bottom up in terms of covering the NFL. You have to be a journalist first. You have to know what a good story is. You have to know you know, how to write a story, how to tell a story. You don't just wander up to a TV studio and become a presenter. So, you know, for me, it's about getting that grounding. I say it to young people who want to be journalists all the time. You know, go and get the grounding. And they kind of say, well, I don't want to go and work on a local newspaper. I want to do what you do. Well, like I just said, from 1991 to 2006, I was just writing about the NFL. Didn't become a full-time TV presenter on the NFL until 20 years after I'd started covering the NFL. So you do have to put in the groundwork.
Okay. And lastly, Andrea Morrell, sorry if I pronounced that wrong, is asking, have you ever done an interview with someone who just didn't want to give much away?
Don't you think that's Andrea? Not Andrea. I'm going to go, I reckon that's the lady. I reckon that's Andrea. Oh,
Andrea.
You think it's some, you think maybe it's an Italian continental person. Okay, so it's either an Italian man called Andrea Morrell or it's Andrea Morrell. But what was the question again?
Have you ever done an interview with someone who just didn't want to give much away? I think we all have,
yes.
Right?
Yeah, everyone has. Absolutely. Right. So I've got three that spring to mind. One will be absolutely no surprise to anyone in New England Patriots head coach Bill Belichick. So it's really interesting with Belichick. I interviewed him one-on-one in training camp in 2009, the year before the Patriots came and played in London for the first time. And basically, they were practicing out on the fields outside of Gillette Stadium. And I got kind of scurried away inside the stadium and then asked to wait on the 50-yard line, actually on the field at Gillette Stadium. And the reason being, they didn't want to give a one-on-one to some guy from the UK, but not the local reporters. So I'm waiting on the 50-yard line, and Belichick kind of hurries out like he's in a hurry. He didn't want to be there, of course, you could tell. And I was trying to at least get the line from him that Tom Brady was on his way to greatness. And you know, we didn't necessarily maybe think of Brady as the greatest of all time at that stage, but he was certainly on his way. And all I wanted was an inclination that Belichick accepted that, and he just would not give me anything more than, well, you know, Tom's pretty good and we're lucky to have him. So that was one. Belichick, it was like getting blood out of a stone. And I've interviewed him, or I've asked him questions at press conferences since then. It's never got any easier, but every journalist has that Bill Belichick story to tell. Jeff Fisher, when he was coach of the Rams in 2012 in training camp, I got allotted 10 minutes with Coach Fisher. Everything was like answered with a straight bat. The chairs were facing each other, and the door which he came in and out of was over my left shoulder. He never sat facing me the entire 10 minutes. His feet were facing the door the entire time. And literally, the last question, as soon as it was answered, he sprung out of the seat, didn't even have to turn his body. He just raced out of the door, and he gave me 10 minutes. You know, he gave me the full 10 minutes. He didn't give me a lot of great answers, and he didn't even look at me straight on. He was facing the door the whole time. And then the last one was actually Dan Marino, who was my hero when I grew up. Loved Dan Marino, had Dan Marino posters on my wall. And I did an extended interview with Marino around the fan rally in Trafalgar Square in London in 2015. And Dan could not have been more guarded, more kind of nervous about what I was going to ask it. What are you going to ask me? Yeah, you know, well, you're not going to make me look bad, are you? And it's like, no, Dan, I'm here for you. I'm being hired by the NFL to make you look good for all these fans who grew up watching you. But he was so nervous. And so I think his guard was up. He didn't give tremendous answers. So there's three. I mean, but everyone has that. Yeah, and then some of them surprise you when you go, you know, Sean Payton was the opposite. Sean Payton can be prickly with some of the media in the US. Could not have been more charming, could not have been more open, and gave me a good 15 minutes a couple of years ago. So sometimes they surprise you, and sometimes they live up to their reputation, which was Belichick. So yeah, it was everyone's got one of those stories.
Right, just to confirm, while you were giving that response, I looked it up because that question came from your Twitter post. Andrea is Andrea.
Andrea, I apologise on
behalf
of
Gary Hayes. She is a Green Bay fan from the West Midlands, evidently, so I apologise.
Andrea, I apologise, and this is why Gary's the producer and not the presenter.
So, speaking of questions, if anyone wants to get a question in for episode 3, which comes out in 2 weeks, how do they do it, Neil?
So Twitter's the best one for me, at Neil Reynolds NFL or at the NR podcast. And yeah, looking forward to the next one. It's going to be a good one. Different, again, just looking at covering off different people in the world of professional football in the NFL. So we've had a player in Ryan Fitzpatrick. We've had a head coach now in Bruce Arians. And next up, it's going to be Peter King from NBC Sports, who for me is the number one NFL journalist in the entire world. So looking forward to that one. This episode was hosted by myself, Neil Reynolds. Our producer is Gary Hayes, while Matt Alabaster is responsible for all of our artwork. Taylor Hayes mixed this episode and also composed our theme music. Special thanks to junior producer Henry Smith and everyone else involved in helping us put this episode together. The Neil Reynolds Podcast is a Highway 61 production for the Reynolds Podcast Network.